afternoon I'm in Cambridge in Wesley House with the Reverend Dr. Richard Clutterbuck, who had the misfortune of trying to teach me theology along with Elizabeth Harper as people on the staff at WemTech many years ago. So it's lovely to be here.
And it's good to have you.
And he's just fed me ice cream because I forgot to say I can't eat scones. So it was really lovely ice cream. So the first question is, how and where did we first meet?
Well, you've reminded me, which I'm grateful for, that we must have met at the induction weekend for new WemTech students in 2001.
Yep.
And I can't remember where that was.
It was somewhere in Wales in the middle of nowhere. I think it might have been Langasti.
I think it could well be, by the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think the test was if you could get there, you'd probably get through the train.
Do you know, it really felt like that on the way there.
I remember, I don't know if it was that occasion, we arrived and we'd had to go through floods and storms and it was dark and people were moaning. And I said, just wait till the morning. And in the morning, we looked out on this beautiful lake and wonderful scenery.
I think for all of us, it was just such an emotional weekend. Because it was the weekend after the World Trade Center attacks.
Oh, of course. I hadn't made that connection, but it was. It was really a very emotional time.
So it was a strange time to be starting something brand new, especially that sort of thing. The next question is, do you drink tea?
As you see, I do. Though I'm not very good at drinking traditional tea. I don't often drink builder's tea or even Yorkshire tea.
So that leads really nicely onto what's your favourite tea?
Well, I think my most common tea is peppermint tea, but that's not really tea. That's really a herb infusion. So if you're asking me about tea, it's what we're drinking now, which is Mango Tango with just a touch of the tropics.
It's really nice. Sometimes I don't like mango tea, but I really do like this. So that's great. On to the whole question. Everyone in the project is being asked this question. How do you respond to the statement, Christianity in the UK is not dying, but sleeping?
I found myself coming back. I've been working in Ireland for 13 years, where the relationship between Christianity and society is rather different. It is changing very quickly. What has happened over my lifetime in England has happened very quickly over a few years, or is happening in Ireland. But coming back to England after a few years, you do get a sense of stepping into a more secular society, into, at least in the case of the Methodist Church, a church that looks a bit threadbare, isn't quite sure how it fits into this new situation. So I'm not sure that I would say asleep. That sounds as if Christianity is inactive. I think Christianity is perhaps increasingly active, but in a number of different ways, and is still trying to work out what it means to be an active church in a society where not everybody is Christian.
So I guess the question, which a lot of people have commented on, is to do with Christendom in the UK. Do you think Ireland still has a Christendom model and the rest of the UK doesn't?
I think we're all in slightly different places. I don't think even in Britain you could say that Christendom is entirely dead. The church I most often attend at the moment is Tewkesbury Abbey, where one of my daughters sings in the choir. And at one level, they are very nonconformist because they're fairly extreme Anglo-Catholic with a what I might call a bonkers approach to liturgy. and ritual. So they attract people who go for that kind of thing, people who have a high tolerance to incense and so on. On the other hand, there are occasions when the church just fills up to its enormous capacity and they touch something of the residual spirituality of society. I think in Ireland, Christianity still feels a bit more normal, you know. So I was driving through the town of Moira about a year ago, and there was a street evangelist who was standing there with a poster that said John 3:16. And he has just assumed that the people who were going by might be unsaved, but they'd know what John 3:16 said.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
And you couldn't imagine someone in the middle of Cambridge doing the same thing. So there's a kind of residual in Ireland. We know what Christianity is, even if we're not currently doing very much about it.
I don't know if you had a card which said John 3:16 and showed it to people in Cambridge, whether they would know what it was referring to or not. But I think it would be a good thing to do in other towns and cities. It would be quite a good survey, wouldn't it, of actually, how people's understanding has changed. I'm intrigued.
I think there are some churches where you might be surprised how few people knew what that was.
I think I'm even wondering if some people would not know that was from the Bible.
Mm.
Question one of the extra theological questions. How could the Church of England understand and collaborate with the church in the UK more productively?
So you'll have to tell me what you mean by the new church in the UK.
I think I mean, how could the Church of England understand and collaborate with the church in Wales, Scotland and all of Ireland?
Okay, I see what you mean. I think that's an interesting and difficult question because it touches on, as a Methodist who's done an awful lot of work with Anglicans, of there's one Methodist church that covers England, Wales and Scotland, but it has a covenant with the Church of England. And so Welsh Methodists and Scottish Methodists kind of wonder how they relate to that. And as I understand it, Scottish Anglicans get a bit uppity if the Church of England starts doing things north of the border. In Ireland, the Church of Ireland, as an Anglican church, operates across two national jurisdictions, Northern Ireland's part of the UK and the Republic of Ireland, which I think is, there's something quite healthy about a church that's not determined by national boundaries. It brings all sorts of things into play. They have different sets of prayers that you say, whether you pray for the Queen or the President or Parliament or the Doyle, will depend on which side of the border you are. I don't think that really answers your question. I suppose it touches on the difference between being C of E and being Anglican.
That's one of the issues, I think.
And one of my best friends, this is totally off your question, slightly, is the Anglican Archbishop of Polynesia. And he's Tongan himself, but he's based in Fiji. And he's one of the primates, and he's often here for Anglican communion things. And I've been out and I've done some work with him. And I think, there's a world of difference between Anglicans as rather a small minority of Christians in Fiji, where most are Methodist, and England, where C of E has been the default setting for people. And I think I think listening to people from other parts of the world might be part of the way forward on that.
Mm. This is my question about evangelicalism. Mm. And it has a long introduction, so bear with me. So recently I have found some friends who had strong, committed evangelical Christian faith in the late 1980s, have left church, but an Anglo-Catholic friend speaks of going to church whatever the state of his personal belief stroke faith at any one time. And I'm wondering whether an emphasis on personal conversionism has encouraged or even compelled those with doubt to leave the church. Mm. I'm wondering what you think.
I could talk quite a long time about that, but you probably don't want me to.
Go ahead, I've got the edit button at home.
Because as a Methodist, I'm part of a tradition that has gone a touch bananas on experience. So we talk about the quadrilateral of scripture, tradition, reason and experience. And we kind of think that John Wesley invented that, which of course he didn't. But it's been a big part of that tradition. And I've kind of found myself rebelling against that since I was a late teenager. And I can remember walking out of some evangelistic jolly in Cliff College, Derbyshire, and thinking, if I'm going to stick with this Christianity business, it's got to be different from this, because this is a mould that I don't fit into. And I think part of my interest in theology is to say there has to be more to God than how I feel when I wake up in the morning. And that doesn't mean that experience can't be important, but I'm really quite fearful of a faith that is totally rooted in our feelings, because if other people are anything like me, feelings can come and go. The sense of the presence of God can be strong at one time and seem to evaporate at another. So yes, I think that having something that keeps you going, even if you don't at that moment feel it, is important. I'm going to answer one of your next questions around the arches.
Okay. Where's
he going with this? I can see she's asking.
I'm trying to wonder what the next question is.
Shula in the Arches. I'm sure you listen to the Arches because you're a country vicar. Has just announced to her husband of many years that she wants to split up, because she doesn't feel for him in the same way anymore. And I just don't understand what that means, because why would you feel exactly the same way at one point compared with another? That's not what you sign up to, and I don't think that's what you sign up to as a Christian, to feel exactly the same way. Though I think I can see, I can see the point, and I have been myself in situations to be encouraged to go down to the roots of my commitment, and that involves something experiential. When John Wesley was going through a spiritual crisis, someone said to him, "Preach faith until you have it." You know, so. You know, there are times, I think, when you you affirm what you don't necessarily feel emotionally.
Emotions are very fickle things. We have a particularly hangry family where we are hungry. We won't be able to cope with anything. We have to all have a biscuit before we can then recommence our argument, which is always better. I think that just shows how, as humans, we are very physically affected by what's going on, whilst God is unchangeable.
I wrote a book a few years ago on why doctrine is more important than most people think it is. And part of that was to trace the way in which in the 17th and 18th century, doctrine went out of fashion, and emotion tended to be one of the ways of replacing it. And I don't think that's always a happy result.
Maybe we'll move on to the doctrine question.
Yeah.
So.
Bring it on.
This really sounds like an essay question, doesn't it? How does our understanding of doctrine work in a world where meta-narrative has collapsed?
It is an essay question. I don't know that meta-narrative has collapsed. It's just there seem to be an awful lot of them. And it's kind of how do people who come from different cultures and different political tribalisms, as it were, inhabit the same story, rather than developing narratives that claim to be the truth and denounce everybody else's as fake news. For me, doctrine, I think it's important that doctrine doesn't simply stand on its own as a set of propositions that we sign up to. And there's been, I think that was one of the reasons why doctrine started to get a bad name in the 17th and 18th century, that there had been too much of a right. If we accept this, then we've got to accept that, and before you know it, you've got this huge syllogism that embraces more than the Bible would ever want you to get into. It relates to our previous question that if doctrine is related to a set of practices, a way of life, and if doctrine is related to the narrative that we tell about ourselves and our community, then it stops it being dry, propositional stuff. If this was an essay, the first thing on my bibliography would be George Lindbeck's The Nature of Doctrine, which is imperfect, but does a lot of that kind of work. So I don't think that meta-narratives are dead. I think that one of the things in our, I don't like the term post-modernity. I've come to the conclusion that postmodernism is invented by the Apple Corporation to make us buy more of their products. So our situation in late modernity is that there are lots of competing meta-narratives. And I think it's an environment where the church can articulate its own meta-narrative, recognizing that everybody is fighting for it. And the same is true of European science, the same is true of European liberalism, the same is true of, you know, all sorts of stuff.
I need to come to the last question. What is your favourite thing, beginning with tea?
I thought about that, and so I'm cheating by saying the Arches.
That's very funny. I thought you were going to say theology. But the Arches is a really good answer.
There's a lot of theology in the Arches. Not all of it's good theology. But a Methodist minister has recently published a chapter on the theology of the Arches in a book on the Arches.
I shall have to have a look at that whilst I'm unspottable. So thank you very much for having a cup of tea with me today in Cambridge.
And thank you for coming.